Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Stephen Jenkinson. He's a culture activist, teacher, author, and ceremonialist. He's the author of numerous books, including Come of Age, The Case for Elderhood in a Time of Trouble, and Die Wise, A Manifesto for Sanity and Soul. So first off, thank you for your work in the world, and second, thank you for being on the program.
Amen. Thanks for the invitation. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you. And I also want to thank you personally for how much you helped save my life through my mom's death. So this is a little bit odd because I'm interviewing you, but I want to tell a little bit of a story to start and then turn it over to you. And the story I want to tell is my mom died about 15 or 16 months ago, and for the last 30 years of her life, I was her sole caretaker, which actually I wasn't a caretaker for most of that time. Most of the time we were just having fun, and you know, she was a wonderful elder that I would hang out with, and we had a great time. But then she got cancer and took about six months, and it was just awful. And that's one of the places your work has helped me survive. And I want to say a few things and then ask you to help all of us through this terrible situation that we're in. Mm-hmm. And the first is that I think that the word sole caretaker and dying of cancer should never go in the same sentence. It takes a community to help an elder, and it takes a community to help somebody die. And we don't have communities for the most part. And also in normal communities, we'd be familiar with death. I was at the time 57, and in a normal community, I would have seen lots of people die by then. And I grew up in the country, so I've seen lots of animals and plants die, and I've caused lots of animals and plants to die. Mm-hmm. And my grandma died a long time ago, but she was, you know, I knew my grandma, but this wasn't like being in the same room. And it wasn't like being there for months with them. And then when I was going through this process with my mom, when she was going through the process and I was with her, I also discovered that there are lots and lots of people in that same circumstance, that they're going through this by themselves. And so that is an atrocity, I think. So having said all this, two things. One is just a plaintive cry of, can you help us? And one more thing, sorry, is that we also don't have a spiritual context for all this. That, you know, in the Middle Ages, there was at least Catholicism to carry us through, or, you know, whatever religion people had. And we, you know, in these times, we don't really have that. And in any case, so, you know, help all of us to understand this. And also, one of the questions you ask in all your work, and maybe I should have just started with this, is, what does it mean to die well? So now I'm just going to throw that whole mess in your lap.
Okay. Well, maybe I'll start with the last one first. First of all, you're very kind to attribute any assistance I inadvertently lent to your circumstance. You know, the lion's share of the work, of course, is done by the people who are there, and the occasional appearance of a stranger by spoken word or by something that they've written is just a happy coincidence, and not to be counted on, but certainly to be appreciated, at least on my end. So I do appreciate what you've told me, and it's one of the reasons, and there's not many of them, for me to carry on against insane and crazy making odds in this regard. Well, so the last thing first, how did it get like this? Has it always been this way? It was interesting. They said at least there was medieval Catholicism, which makes the current circumstance sound somehow less ennobled than even those grim times. And right. I don't think you're wrong in that characterization either. You know, many's the time when I worked in the death trade that people asked me in interviews whether I thought that people who had a religious or a spiritual practice or orientation of some kind had a better time of it when the time was upon them. And to their extraordinary surprise and disappointment, I would have to say, my standard answer was no. I didn't see any upside to people's spirituality when crunch time came. And here's why. Virtually everyone who brought that kind of material to the table did so in an adversarial relationship to what was happening. And they employed their spirituality as a way of coping, contending, holding at bay, defeating for the time being, otherwise result. You get the point. And all of it was to make as if the dying had no place and didn't belong and was erroneously appearing and, had got the wrong address and the wrong person and so on and so on. So obviously, if you craft a spiritual orientation that's not in keeping with the realities of dying, in tune with them, informed by them, and ultimately serving them, you're left with a one-note symphony of resistance at almost any cost for as long as you can, and then you collapse in a heap in a corner, hopefully for the last 36 hours, sedated, slack-jawed, and drooling. Yeah, it's a grim picture all the way around, not just in the last 36 hours. So until spirituality, quote unquote, not my term, by the way, or my favorite word, but until that is informed by the realities of dying to the point where it's dying's ally and you're its beneficiary, we're in deep trouble. That's one. Two, how did it get like this? Well, you know, I'm no expert, but I did have a brief but intense sojourn in the death trade, and I have no reason to exaggerate anything I saw. So for what it's worth, it seems to me that the kind of macro take on this thing has to include, if we're talking about North America now, which is the only place I should reasonably refer to, you know, the white folks here got our start in the, not as exiles, that would be too noble, not even as refugees, that would be too directed. We got our marching orders from our flight. That's really the unauthorized history of how we ended up here and what we've been doing ever since, it seems to me. We were running, and we were running according to a myth or a fable or a fantasy that Europe fashioned called the New World. Of course, there was nothing new about it to the people who lived here, but we fashioned a fantasy as kind of subsequent Europeans and have tried to inhabit that fantasy ever since. Your country in particular is very enamored of this idea that it was a fresh start, but there was nothing fresh about it because people on the run don't have fresh starts. People on the run don't know when to stop running. That's the nature of the trauma that they're engaged with. They bring the trauma with them inadvertently, and their way of trying to reestablish themselves sustains the trauma in the name of trying to solve it. And then you have the circumstance where you ask yourself, who came? Was it the downtrodden and oppressed? Probably not. They couldn't afford to come. So you already get the idea that the people who came were, to a certain degree, beneficiaries of the thing that they were trying to get away from. Secondly, did they bring their old people with them? Almost certainly they didn't. And if they did, how many of them survived the middle passage across the Atlantic? I dare say not many. So what you have is a circumstance where people are on the run and they're rudderless because they're essentially two generations, you know, some kind of early to mid-middle-aged folks and their dependents, their foundlings and so on. And the old people are nowhere to be found. And so that's how we began. And that's the part that they don't tell us much about in school. And finally, with the kind of cultural rupture that involuntary flight from Europe represented, there's no continuity for people who look like me living on this continent. No shared understanding, no received tradition that tells us clearly what's to become of us as we die, when we're dying, once we die, and in the fullness of time. We are utterly on our own, as you said at the beginning. There is no we in that regard. The poverty couldn't be more acute and frankly heartbreaking. It masquerades as strength, of course, when we're firing on all cylinders and we've got enough money. But when either one of those things are compromised, the dearth possibility begins to really show itself then. So you add all this up and you say properly, we don't stand a chance when death comes to call. And that's basically true. I don't mean that in the sense of we don't stand a chance of surviving dying. There's a certain point at which you shouldn't be able to survive dying. What I mean is, when dying comes to call, all it can be is your undoing instead of the rest of your doing. Because that's how I understand dying. I've had to wrestle this beast so many times, and I did so, of course, with culturally one hand tied behind my back, because I'm no more achieved than anybody else in these regards. But I had to find some way of scrambling, and the only way I could do it finally was to craft a language where the realities of dying actually appeared instead of were banished in the act of trying to talk about them. And that's what I saw virtually every day. That's what you hear me trying to do right now. And even though I've lived with these things for years and years and years now, still as I think about it in response to what you've asked me, I feel a bit undone by what I saw. And the tragedy of it has never really diminished. People died badly in any sane definition of the term, in their legions, in the most materially sophisticated, medically proficient environment that you could imagine. I worked in downtown Toronto, one of the hubs of, med tech in North America. And people did everything to people. And the hesitation was scant, and there should have been a lot more hesitation, a lot more uncertainty that was fessed up to instead of knuckled under to when there was nothing else to do. Finally, my country has basically legalized euthanasia across all the provinces now. So it's possible to exit when you see fit or when it suits you to do so. And, this is taken by its advocates and by its champions to be a mark of real sanity in a culture that prides itself on being sane and peace-loving and all the rest. And so I simply wonder aloud, as is my obligation as a citizen, whether or not euthanasia in practice achieves what its champions held it out to be achieving. And the inquiry is actually quite simple, and it goes like this. So people get to die. There's a few hoops to jump, but basically they get to die when they want to, now, when they've had enough. And is there such a thing as enough already? Of course there is. But you sound like you're not entirely in favor of it. Well, my personal opinion about it is really irrelevant, but I'll wonder about it, though. And I'll wonder about it like this. So we were a death-phobic culture prior to the advent of euthanasia. And its incomingness is supposed to have softened our death phobia. But the point is, it was a death phobic culture that legalized euthanasia. And if you simply take that at face value, then you begin to realize the decision to do so is consistent with the death phobia. Because the proposition is a death phobic culture legalized euthanasia. And no death phobic culture would do so if it were attempting to undo itself. You see, it's a measure that a death phobic culture prescribes for its own death phobia. And the irony of ironies is, on the other side of the practice, the death phobia is intact. I don't say that it's aggrandized necessarily, but it's certainly intact, deeply unchallenged by the advent of this thing. And another example of, for all the right reasons, in our poverties, we tend to do the wrong things.
So what, I have a couple questions here, and you can take either one you want or both, whatever.
Okay.
One of them is, what would a culture look like that was not death phobic? And the other question is, you know, it's very clear that this culture is destroying the planet. And there have been a lot of people, Eric Fromm, myself, frankly, who have written about this culture being driven by a death urge. And it's always seemed to me that there is a relationship between the death phobia and the fact that this culture is killing everything.
Mm-hmm.
And so would you like to go to talk about either of those questions?
Sure. Sure. let's see. A death phobic culture and its denizens, in my view, are not particularly enamored of death. They're not death-centered. They're not death-obsessed or preoccupied, no more so than any other culture seems to be. So that's something that may not be expected, you know. To say that somebody's death-phobic is not to say that they're death-preoccupied. It's simply to say that whenever the subject tends to arise, there are other preferences that are exercised. That's a benign way of describing it. So while I take your point that the dominant culture of North America seems insanely bent on fouling its own nest to a terminal degree, I wouldn't associate that practice with a kind of mindfulness around its own death phobia, as if it's extending its death phobia in the direction of willing the demise of what it relies upon. Because that wouldn't really be death phobic, right? You would do everything you can to avoid willing yourself towards your own demise if you were deeply practicing your death phobia. So, and of course, we seem to be doing the opposite. So ironically, my take on it might be something closer to death phobia has a kind of partner in crime, which I've come to call grief illiteracy. And these things, you find one, you often find the other. And why do I not say grief phobia along with death phobia? Well, because in my years in the trade, one of the things I began to realize is the phobia is aided and abetted by a kind of truancy, a psychic, spiritual, an existential truancy. Dereliction of duty, that kind of thing. And I characterize it as being illiterate where grief is concerned. I've been getting a lot of calls and a lot of invitations to be interviewed, of course, during the onrush of this virus. And typically people will characterize this time as a grief-filled time. And it falls to me to say, well, if you're asking me, I would disagree with you in the extreme. The advent of this virus has done nothing to deepen people's capacity for grief. What it has done is bolster their unwillingness to be obliged to grieve and rather exercise their right to opt out if it suits them once the all clear whistle is blown. So the irony of the situation is there's nothing inevitable about grieving in a moment that seems built for grief. If human grief was inevitable, a job like I had in a place like I worked would never occur. See, my gig, my job was a direct consequence of the unlikelihood of people grieving in a circumstance that seems to beg for it. So no learning results in no practice. No practice results in intergenerational inheritance of this disability, of course masquerading as a kind of aloofness or a kind of strength. I'll give you a very brief example, and then we'll go to the cultural question that you asked. Some years ago, I was talking somewhere, and a woman came up to me at the end and she said, well, that's all well and good for other people, but it doesn't do me any good. I said, yeah. She was waiting for me to, you know, sell her. And I just said, yeah. She said, well, do you want to know why? I said, well, I think you're going to tell me. You go ahead. She said, well, here's the thing. Nobody close to me has died. Now, I looked at her, and I would say she was probably in her mid to late 50s when she said this to me. And I looked in her eyes when she said, and I realized she didn't know that she was confessing. She thought she was describing in some kind of neutral way a relatively uneventful life. What she was actually telling me is she'd stayed away sufficiently enough that no one close to her had died. Of course, many people had died in her purview, but her negotiation of distance seemed to have achieved something like equanimity. That's what grief illiteracy looks like on the ground. As far as the cultural question about what would it look like if we were saner? Well, you know, I understand the draw of the question, but I myself have never been particularly compelled by it. And here's why. If we continue to generate fascination around solutions, and I'm preaching to the choir here, I'm well aware when I'm saying such a thing to you. But if we continue to preoccupy ourselves with solutions, the unwillingness to engage ourselves at the level of our ongoing impoverishment will be the thing that drives our solution mongering incessantly. And that's what I've seen in the trade and outside of it. So my inclination when I'm asked a question like that is to make a plea for us to learn our poverties rather than to rely on some other culture's sanity in this regard. And it's not being coy. It's simply saying, I'm not sure that we'd have any capacity to engage another culture's sanity around dying until we come deeply familiar with the poverties that drive us to somebody else's doorstep.
Thank you for all that. And I have two stories that I want to tell, which I hope may spark something or another. And one is of a terrible thing I did, and the other is of one of a beautiful thing that happened during my mom's death.
Okay.
And the terrible thing is, and this has to do with grieving, is that because I was a sole caretaker toward the end, I was very sleep deprived, and after my mom had entered terminal delirium, but before she had become non-responsive, or whatever we want to call it, before she had lost speech, let's say.
Yeah.
The last night, I had not slept for two nights, and I lost my patience with her when she got up yet again, and she couldn't stand. So every time she would start to get up, I would have to hold her, and I wasn't abusive to her, but after all these decades of loving her and of conversations, I got really upset with her. And I mean, for the rest of my life, I will regret that I couldn't hang on for one more day.
Mm-hmm.
And then because my mom only wanted family, and there, for various reasons, my family was not very helpful.
Mm-hmm.
And after my mom was no longer able to speak, my niece is Mormon, and she had asked to have some whole bunch of Mormon women to come in to help. And once my mom was not responsive, they were able to take over some, and I was able to just love my mom into death and to grieve some. I love your phrase, grief illiteracy, because I don't know how, but up until then, I was so busy, you know, trying to physically carry her to the bathroom that there wasn't capacity there. I could not afford to grieve as well. So that's one story that is horrifying to me. And the other story, which is kind of beautiful, is that my mom had a long relationship with this one bear that she called Mama, and she would see the bear every day. And then the bear had gone away for many years, and we didn't know if she was dead. We didn't know if she had just moved to another territory. Anyway, about a week before my mom entered terminal delirium, Mama showed up and sat outside for about 2 days and then left. And at the time my mom said, well, either she's telling me I'm going to get better or she's telling me goodbye. And I said to my mom, I think she's telling you that everything's going to be okay. Anyway, so those are the two stories, if you want to respond to either of them at all.
Mm. Well, you know, the first story that you told, no sane place is it written that a circumstance, as you described it, brings out the best in us. It's alleged from place to place and time to time. But if the deep realities can be born, the truth of the matter is that a circumstance like you've described, particularly the austerity of the circumstances that you describe, and the kind of singular threadbareness of it all, can't possibly sustain either one of you in crunch time. And that's the irony, is that the caregiving itself has to be sustained. It can't do all the sustaining. You know, it has to be on the receiving end of some kind of sustenance or nurturance. And it can't simply be the relationship that the two of you had prior to the onset of her, I believe it was cancer, I'm not sure. And so now you're back to the observation you made at the beginning, which is you were doing it basically alone. And while you could lay that circumstance at the feet of some, say, uncooperative family members, the truth of the matter is it's too much for one family too, at least nuclear family. And you realize, oh man, we're into the circumstance of without a village. You know, the old adage that everybody seems to be able to quote about it, what it takes to raise a child. Yeah, and it's usually attributed to some mythical African place. There's a lot of people that know that it takes a village to raise a child. Not nearly as many people acknowledge that it takes a village to bury one, or to bury, you know, a child of any age, a child of the culture, a child of the time, even unto their 70s and 80s. Of course it does. And when you don't have that, you're firing on cylinders of intention only. That's all you've got left. And the intention is a servant of something, you know. It's not the boss. And I'm not saying this to assure you that you didn't do any harm or that, you know, or anything of the kind. I'm speaking to you like a fellow grown-up here and acknowledging that there are circumstances like what you've described which don't bring out the best in us and can't if we're the only one there. And so, sadly, as much as it might be a personal indictment of your bad judgment about, you know, should you have walked out of the room or whatever, it's really an indictment of all the life that was lived prior to that evening or that afternoon, that where people couldn't be drawn upon, or your mother wouldn't have it, or whatever the particulars are. But, you know, how you die is how you lived. And the truth is that we would wish otherwise for an awful lot of people when crunch time comes. That's a really harsh lesson that I learned, is that if you think that there's a time that's made in time heaven for the best of us to come forward and to proliferate and to manifest and to burst into, you know, beautiful flower, you will wait in vain if you think dying is one of those times. And you could say from that, my God, man, you're embittered beyond belief by what you saw. First of all, I'm not bitter. Okay. But what I am is informed. Did I see alternatives to the kind of dying I've been alluding to? Generally speaking, I did not. Why didn't you? Well, because they didn't need me. That's why. My responsibility was to be obsolete, or to become obsolete, to to democratize the death wisdom that I was entrusted with, and to charge the family with that kind of wisdom and whatever practice could ensue from that. And those families that were willing to take that on, you know, I was the first casualty of their capacity, and glad to be that. So of course, mostly what I saw was deaths at various levels of catastrophe. And a bad death, by definition, I came to learn, is an inward turned, self-possessed, personal possession, private and privacy making, isolation, reliant. So you get the general idea. It's the very atrophy of the village mindedness that we need to be able to walk away in hard times, and then to be able to walk back with not very much harm done.
I thought about this very much when I was writing my book, Culture Make Believe, and particularly, this has always stuck with me 20 years later, particularly when I was writing about all the men from China who died building the transcontinental railroads, mm-hmm. and and you were talking about the people fleeing to this new continent,
right.
and how it was back then, travel that distance. And the same is true today, that when you emigrate to a new country, to a new place, especially back then with slower travel, you were saying goodbye to your family for the last time.
Certainly.
And I have no point here except that it was, again, the antithesis of community that, you know, they came to Americas and ended up in a grave in Montana or Nevada.
Yeah. That's as it is when you decide that another place, that you deserve the other place, not the place you were born to. I mean, what we're experiencing right now with this virus is, among other things, the intense visitation of our instinct for globalization. And, you know, without making light of personal suffering of the kind that you described with railroad workers and so on, the unwillingness to work on behalf of a better day in the place that you find yourself has consequences that you don't intend. And as many success stories as can be written, they tend to be the ones that people read. There are those unmarked graves in their thousands on both, you know, coasts of the continent and everywhere in between. And I'm lucky enough to have a school, and the first book I teach in the school is a book about the consequences of the Irish potato famine. It's a novel called The Law of Dreams. And the irony is, although I didn't learn it when I first bought the farm I'm speaking to you from now, it turns out that I'm teaching the school on a piece of land, a farmland, that was cleared by people who had barely survived the Irish potato famine and ended up here in the late 1840s. And we're literally sitting in the place that should never have been cleared because it's no good farmland, by the people who were in no shape to call themselves cultural pioneers or instigators. So it's a hard, you know, it's one of the hard lessons of the unauthorized history of, at least of America. I don't mean the United States of, I mean the idea of America, that it really conned itself almost from the beginning in order to be able to keep going, in order to more or less mindlessly proclaim its manifest destiny. And it's extraordinary that its great-grandchildren are no less afflicted of the things that their great grandparents apparently did everything they could do to avoid.
What? I completely agree with you that we are grief illiterate. And I absolutely positively don't mean to personalize this. Mm-hmm. So I do mean this personally, having just said that. And I also mean it socially. It's like, what, recognizing that we are grief illiterate, what then?
Yeah. Well, we're answering what then. That's not a hypothetical question. What then simply means, what are we doing with our unlearnedness? And of course, the answer is we're proliferating it. We're investing in it. So, but I think your question means, what might be done given all of that?
Yes.
Okay. So the first then, if grief is a question of learning, it's not a question of feeling anything at all. It's a question of learning the vocabulary, learning the valence of grief, the architecture of grief, and not intuitively, but I mean, the cultures that we might hold up as exemplars of this practice, none of them go with their gut. Their guts, if you will, are educated culturally. Their guts are, how should I put this? They're made to get in line, culturally speaking, and learn the cultural norms by which grief is translated and manifest and acted upon and so on. People are not left to their own devices in places such as those. That would constitute something deeply transgressive for you to, you know, imagine yourself towards a personal expression of grief. Grief is fundamentally a cultural currency that's entrusted to individuals. That's one thing I would say about it. So the second thing is, if you've not learned grief, you've not learned how to learn grief either. So it's a kind of second order poverty, which is much more devastating than the first. Because if you don't think about it deeply, you imagine that, okay, I haven't learned it yet, but I'm willing to learn it now. And that's like imagining that you're going to do some kind of Olympic event now that you've finally retired from the office. Never having prepared for it, your body singularly incapable of beginning to approach the training that would be necessary. At this point, if I'm you, I'm thinking, well, what are you saying, that it's all for naught? Well, a lot of it is, yes. Is there such a thing as too late in the arc of an individual person's life in the West to come to their senses and stop trying to come to somebody else's senses instead? Yes, I'm certainly saying that there's such a thing as too late. I was in the too late business, Derek, you see. So this is not a matter of opinion, and there's no joy for me in saying it. But if we don't recognize there's such a thing as too late at the level of this grief, how are we ever supposed to come to an understanding of what ecological too lateness, or anyway, how? And I can't see how. So the order of the day might be something like this. If we're willing to know deeply the fact of our dying, the ongoing ontological presence of our death, then one of the first casualties would be the language that we use to describe, quote, sudden death. There's no such thing as sudden death. When you describe a death as sudden, you're confessing the truancy I was talking about earlier. Because the givenness of your death is a present moment proposition. It's not hypothetical. You and I are talking about something that's here, not something that's in the future. everything you need to know about your death, you know now. And, you know, I could imagine either yourself or people objecting, saying, well, I don't know the hour, I don't know the minute, I don't know the cause or the circumstances. At which point I would say, it's exactly, do you not recognize mercy in that? Because there is mercy in that. What do you imagine you would do with that particular kind of biographical data? Do you imagine it would ready you, enable you, that you would live your life more finely tuned to that date on the calendar that you get to circle? Which, of course, ultimately is what euthanasia gives you. I submit to you, the likelihood is not great. The consequences would be confounding, dumbfounding, traumatizing, and finally terrorizing as the oncomingness of the day visits you. So I'm suggesting something else, I guess. It's the idea that if you're willing to know that you are going to die now, not that your death is right now, but that you know you're going to die now, maybe that could inform how you carry yourself through your days when the physical challenges of dying are not with you. Because after all, if you don't practice your dying when you're physically capable of deciding to stop doing it, you know, to take a break from it, how do you imagine you'll ever be able to practice the intelligence around dying when you can't take a break from it, when it's 24/7, all and nothing? So that's what I mean about the second order alertness to grieving. I mean, the last thing I could say about it, and I'm aware that I'm going on here, but.
No, it's great.
Okay. This kind of teaching story came to me a few years ago. There was a time, the 80s, when everybody in North America knew there was enough oil in the ground for everybody for all time, for everything we needed. Everybody knew it, or almost everybody knew it. How could you tell that we knew it? Well, you could tell by how we behaved, the kind of things we bought and when we bought them and how many of them, and how big they were. In other words, it was something in the way we lived that articulated this knowledge of ours about oil. Now, the truth, and both of us know that it was never true. It wasn't true that there was enough oil, but I didn't say it was true. I said that we knew it, which is it's a useful distinction to make. So if you take the word oil out of that little vignette and you put in the word die, everybody knows they're going to die. It has to be a question. I don't think it should be a declaration any longer. It has to be a question. Does everybody know they're going to die? If you ask them, most people, with a few exceptions in the New Age Brigade, will say yes. And then you investigate the way by which they're proceeding with this, quote, knowledge, and you can't find any evidence that the knowledge is present in their decision-making or in how they're proceeding ordinarily and in the mundane times. And that's tragic, because the truth is that most people clearly do not know they're going to die. They may fear, they may suspect, they may be troubled by, but it is not a discrete piece of knowledge by which people can govern themselves. Not from what I've seen. So that kind of alertness to our unwillingness to proceed in the presence of what is there, clear and present now, to cultivate that kind of alertness might go a long way towards helping us not to go to Sri Lanka or the Himalayas or wherever we imagine they've got it straight, but rather stay in the saddle here in the troubled place, and make some kind of rehabilitation of our ongoing low-grade madness in this regard. Soften, such that we become another generation that entrusts our fundamental poverties to the children that we claim to love.
Well, thank you for all of that. And I'm going to switch directions here for a minute, and we have, oh, 5 or 6 minutes left.
Okay.
And I think, I mean, I can't speak for any listener except for myself,
mm-hmm.
but there is so much that needs to be, that you've said that needs to be metabolized. It's like a lot of people can say something and it's like, oh yeah, that's, if you were to tell me, that a certain road is closed, then I can incorporate that information immediately and just drive on a different road.
Yeah.
But everything you're saying needs to be, I love the word ruminate. You know, we need to be like a cow and we need to put it into one stomach and then bring it up and chew on it mm-hmm. and then metabolize it into our bodies. So having said all that, you have mentioned, the school, and I'm guessing that there will be a lot of people listening to this who want a lot more. And can you talk about the school a little bit?
Sure. I call it properly so the Orphan Wisdom School. It's been going for 10, 11 years now. It's my idea. It's the school I wanted to go to and couldn't quite find. So it's a necessity was the mother of this thing, really, for me. And early on, you know, I realized it's not a school about what Jenkinson's figured out or thinks he's figured out or anything of the kind. Although I'm the principal yammerer in the place, you wouldn't say I'm the subject of it in any way at all. What it is a kind of apprenticeship to a kind of principled inquiry. That's its first order of business. But you need a subject matter, right? You can't chew on chewing, to use the cow analogy. So it seemed to me as a citizen of Anglo-North America, probably my principal obligation was to become less a stranger to this place, especially historically. And so it became an inquiry into the unauthorized history of how this place has come to be made in our image, if you will. So you heard me refer to a little bit about some of the notions earlier in one of the answers I gave. It's a very simple architecture. It's twice a year for 2 years, 5 days at a time. People think, that it's a kind of death-centered thing. Well, nothing in North America is a death-centered thing, including the funeral business, including palliative care. None of it is death-centered. I mean, would that it were, but, and the school isn't either. The school is, the idea is apprenticeship properly humbles those most demanding to learn. And I'm really deeply trusting that humbling. You know, it seems to me that we in North America, with all our privilege and good fortune, are not good on the humility thing. We translate it as humiliation far too quickly and are willing to do without it. But being humbled is kind of what the world has in mind for the likes of us, it seems to me. So the school is an attempt to wonder about this, what I call the European fantasy called America, to wonder about it and to see if we can employ a kind of wonder that's not a broken version of the thing we're trying to wonder about. This is a very, very elaborate kind of emotional and intellectual approach that's necessary. And so we take our time. And it's a farm-based thing of all things. I have a farm here, and I was lucky enough to build a teaching hall here several years ago on the proceeds from DieWise, as it happened. And I called it the hall that the man killer tour. So I went out on tour, as you no doubt have done, and came back barely in one piece, but with the proceeds was able to build a proper home for this place of inquiry. and we feed the people from the farm. And all in all, it's a kind of engagement with a deliberate way of life that doesn't present itself as any particular solution. It's one response that I've been able to come up with during the course of my short but intense life to the things that buffaloed me for so long and then drew closer. And when they drew closer, I got a chance. And I mean, the last thing I'd say to you, I guess, about it would be this. I was lucky enough. I went to Harvard Divinity School, and that's not my fortune. My fortune was that when I was there, I met an old black man who was a storyteller who took me on as a kind of undeclared apprentice storyteller. And he stole from me during the 7 or 8 years that I accompanied him as a musician. And I mean this, he took my callow willingness to carp and to moan and to berate what had preceded me as not being fitting of being claimed by me as a kind of ancestry. And he replaced that with one livid and vivid human example of what it looked like for a human being to fully occupy the time that was entrusted to him as a kind of radicalized citizen. And I was not able to proceed in my subsequent life as if I'd never seen that. And that was a blessing beyond anything I could ever describe. And I suppose my school, in an abbreviated and hesitant way, is a child of the theft that he perpetrated upon me.
Well, thank you so much for that. And thank you for all of your extraordinary work in the world. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Stephen Jenkinson. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.